$25 a piece. 2 meter preamp kits for like $25. There's a whole bunch of little things here. Little QRP linear amplifiers for 20, 30, or 40 meters for like $40, $45 in that area. And I mean, they're cute little kits too. I think they're pretty easy to build. And you can either order them with their cases or without.
W2BMP. W2BMP recognized. Baker November Pumper is what it sounds like. We'll get to you in a second. At one time, the Tintec company in Tennessee, I think, also had some nice radio kits. But I believe, except for the preamplifiers and the speech clippers, I think in general they were a little bit more expensive. I wonder if Tintec still is a kit supplier to your knowledge. KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yes, they are, and 2EO.
Yeah, Dick, they definitely are. I guess the thing I'm trying to point out here is that for the beginner, for somebody who's just one step above learning how to solder, that wants to make some small, easy kits you can build in one evening, you can get up and operating with very, very little troubleshooting, I'd say Ramsey's probably the better bet. If you make some things from there that are probably successful, then continue on, go to Tintec and spend a few more dollars and, work on a little bit more advanced kit. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. So, back to you in case you need any fill on a... Oh, let's see what Mr. BNP has got to say. Whiskey 2, I think it's Baker November Papa. Please correct me and tell us your name, sir, and then your information for Jim. You've got it. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. W2, Bravo, Mike Papa. Just to answer your question on the book, they're available from Amazon.com. Used, and electronics used is 99 cents. Basic electronics theory with projects and experiments is 70 cents. So that's a pretty good source of all those old radio W2BMP. Name here, Joe.
Very fine.
Want to comment when you're ready?
Okay, very fine, Joe. Some more good information. Comment when we're ready. Go right ahead to whoever that was.
Yeah, Dick, it's Vito again, PJF. I have a recent MFJ catalog here, and on the back cover there is about 25 little kits, $25, $30, $15, crystal oscillator, blinking lights, and so forth. I'm going to listen for Jim's call sign. I'm going to send the catalog, and he can research that, look it over, and very interesting things. And any other information I come up with, I'm going to send it to Jim as well. So just wanted to make comments. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, Vito, you're all right. And Jim is Kilo Delta 2, Baker November Yankee, and he lives in Fort Washington. Guarantee he's going to appreciate that. So back to you for any fills on any of this, Jim. KD2BNY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Actually, Dick, a correction on the call sign is KD2BHY, Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee. I also have one more quick question for Dick. I have heard that you had listened on the moon landing. You had intercepted the radio communications for the moon landing. I was just curious about how you did that, how you went about doing it.
Yeah, this was on Apollo 15 in 1971 and Apollo 16 later on that year. We did that with a 12-foot diameter homebrew parabolic dish antenna that was made out of window screening and 18 pieces of aluminum tubing as spokes, made this 12-foot diameter parabolic dish, and the spokes were bent into a parabolic shape like a bow and arrow with Dacron fishing string. You can see the article by going to the, let me think now, August issue 1972 QST magazine. August 1972 is the design of the antenna. That article is called a 12-foot stressed parabolic dish. June 1972 QST is the article entitled Houston, This is Apollo by K2RIW and W4HHK. He lives in Tennessee. He and I were both listening to the Apollo astronauts. If you were a QST member, in other words, a ARRL member, you're allowed to go back into the archives and look at these older issues. Also, a well-equipped library will have it. So 1972 was my best year, Jim. The April and May issue, or was it February and March? February and March issue had the article on my 1,000-watt, 432 parallel kilowatt transmitter. So February and March was the transmitter. June was the article on Houston, this is Apollo. And August was the issue that showed you the actual antenna. Let me drop. I had done some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and when the astronauts were using their high-gain antenna aimed at the Earth from their space capsule, I calculated that a 12-foot dish, which I had used to be competitive in an antenna gain contest at 1296 megacycles, and the Apollo astronauts were on 2,000 megacycles, 2287.5 was the command module frequency of the Apollo spacecraft, 2287.5 megahertz. So I did some back-of-the-envelope calculation, realized I would get enough signal for them when they're using the high-gain antenna, even when we're at the lunar distance. I'd written a letter to National Aeronautics and Space Administration asking for the frequencies they used. They know that they were using the 210-foot dish at Goldstone, California. I told them I was about to use a 12-foot dish. They were positive it wouldn't be big enough. They knew I wasn't going to be any real trouble to them, so they told me frequencies and methods of modulation, gave me all kinds of information. And I had some borrowed equipment. I was working on a spectrum analyzer, which acted as the converter that converted the 2,000 meg signal down to 2 meters, where we listened to, was it 2 meters or was it 48 megs? I think it was 2 meters. I think we converted down to 2 meters, actually 227 megacycles to be exact, which was the first IF of the spectrum analyzer I was working on at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I borrowed a parametric amplifier. That's something that AIL was manufacturing. The feed horn was made out of food cans and a paint can. So when you see that article, those two articles, June issue and September issue, when you get a hold of those old 1972 issues, you'll see schematics as to how we did it, what the signal looked like, pictures of the equipment, and so on. I recorded about 3 or 4 hours worth of astronaut audio on Apollo 15 and something like 15 hours of audio on Apollo 16. Most of the recordings that we did, me and my buddies at Airborne Instrument Laboratory, most of those recordings were done at the time. The astronauts were not connected to the ABC, NBC, and CBS networks. So we were hearing their direct communications back to Houston when they know that they were not live on television, if you know what I mean. So we heard some very candid stuff. We heard more technical communications and some of the joking communications. For instance, one of the astronauts on Apollo 16 was a bit of a chow hound, and so in the weightlessness of the capsule, his fellow astronauts would throw little pieces of food at him, and he would position his mouth just right for the food to slowly drift into his mouth and then eat them. And so they were describing things like that during their off hours, if you know what I mean. And there were other more personal things that we heard from time to time. They didn't know that they were on a party line. When I did get a chance to visit Houston headquarters in Texas, that was in 1973, I think it was, or 72. It was after Apollo 13. I did meet Deke Slayton. Deke Slayton was supposed to be an astronaut. When I met him, because he had a heart murmur and wasn't allowed to fly, he became in charge of astronaut training. When he got introduced to me, the guy that was listening to his astronauts while they're in space and telling the world what we heard, and we censored the stuff. We used good judgment on that. He was unhappy to meet me because, from his point of view, his private high-technology communication circuit between his astronauts in space and the ground, from his point of view, had just become a party line because he found out by K2LIW sitting in front of him that other people in the world were listening to that and telling people what they were heard. So he was a bit unhappy to meet me. He didn't treat me quite as nicely. I mean, ordinarily a guy like that would say, hey, good job, and he didn't do that. He was, as I said, kind of unhappy that I existed. That gives you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch. It was a real fun project. What we would do each night is take all the equipment off the benches at AIL, assemble this antenna in the backyard
put it together, listen to the astronaut audio for a few hours, take it all apart at midnight, put it all back on the benches, and go back to work the next morning. We were doing that each night during the Apollo 15 and 16 mission. Back to you for any further questions on this one, Jim. KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee. Sorry about that mistake. K2LAW in the tech net.
Yeah, I have the QSP article on my computer right now. So, 73, Dick, and all that are listening, back to me.
Yeah, give me a couple of words on that. I'm amazed you got it that fast. It sounds like you or your family is a ARRL member. You're allowed to go into the archives once you told them K2RIW, June 1972. Quite often there, their archive website is quite difficult to use and gives me a lot of trouble. You were able to get the article that easily? Is that what you're saying, Jim? Give me a couple of words on that. KD2BHY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I typed in your call sign and it said Houston, this is Apollo. So I downloaded the PDF file and I'm reading it right now. It's pretty interesting.
Very fine, Jim. Study that article. Next Sunday night, I'm going to give you a pop quiz on how much of that information you absorbed and understood. I'm having some fun with you, Jim. But as you can tell, you'd be amazed nowadays how many ham radio operators with equipment they've assembled in their backyard and sometimes at their place of business, where they are now listening to various space probes that go way beyond the lunar distance. A space probe that goes to Mars or Venus or Jupiter, until it gets really far out there. There are people in their backyard with modern day equipment that listen to the unified S-band signals or the X-band signals at 8.5 gigahertz, roughly, with a good parabolic dish and a low-noise preamplifier. You can listen to the carrier from a space probe that is millions of miles away, halfway between here and Jupiter. And there are various people who have done that in the last couple of years as a real fun project. In most cases, they're not getting a strong enough signal that they can really demodulate the figure out the actual data that's on the signal that's measuring battery voltages and current drains and things like that. They don't get enough signal to do that. It's only the major installations that do. But still, amateurs have done that, have been doing it over the last few years and having a lot of fun with that. So you'll enjoy that. As you can tell, once you get into wireless electronics, my goodness, there are a lot of things you can do. And there's no end to it. Okay, the next person who had a question, I think, was John. Let's see. Yeah, we've come up way beyond 9 o'clock, so we should go to the Mel's Corner mailbag. So go right ahead, John. We'll go to the mailbag, then we'll go to Paul with his space report, then we'll come back to John's question. And once again, you might mention to people, my guess is you should put those beautiful pictures of your measurements incorporated grid dip meter, you should put them on your QRZ.com web picture site there, John. That's a beautiful restoration job you've done. KD2, there we go. KC2, WGB, K2RIW. You got it, John.
KC2, WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the web. The net, I should say, the web. Dick, that I own that since 1981. It was a few years old when I bought it, that dip meter. That's a real grid dip meter. It's not just a dip meter. It served me well. I had a defective bearing in it a couple of years ago, which was a mechanical bearing. The original was still available. It was made by Timken. I was able to get that this week and put it all back together, and it's working fine. And you're right about the price. It was roughly about that. I paid used about $1,000 for it at that time, 81. So as you can see, it's pristine. The case is a little beat up, but that instrument works very well. It goes from 50 kilohertz to 1 gig, by the way, Dick. That's why it has three heads.
50 kilohertz to 1 gig. Whoa. That is a lot of frequency range. Whereas the Heathkit grid dip oscillator as a chip, I'm pretty sure the highest frequency was either 150 or 250 megacycles, and I think the lowest frequency may have been 455 KC. There, I'm not sure. Back to you for a correction on that, John, and then go to your first mailbag question. KC2WGB. K2RIW. K2YL. Stand by a minute, John. Go ahead, Bernie. And kind of glad to hear from you tonight.
Just wanted to say I just posted those pictures on the web for anybody that uses the Dropbox TechNet folder. Those pictures are now available.
And a person can see those pictures by going to Hunt Family. Bernie at huntfamily.com, I think it is. Correct me on that one. I think it's Bernie at huntfamily.com. And therefore, each of the website and photographs that we'll be discussing at the later portions of the TechNet are on that particular site, if I got it correctly. K2 Yankee Oscar for a correction. K2 RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, just anybody that's interested, drop me an email at Bernie at huntfamily.com. If you go to QRZ, it's my listed email at QRZ for K2YO. I'll send you a link. All you have to do is create a free account with Dropbox, and bingo, you automatically have all, access to all of the documents that Dick and Wesley and Glenn and all those folks are talking about every night. K2YO.
I've heard somebody say twice, late check-in, but the signal sounds like a mobile and it's extremely weak. Want to give it one more try? K2LIW. Thank goodness you said it two or three times. I think it is Kilo 2, Victor, Delta, November. But we were only getting about 40% copy on your signal. Hopefully when we get a chance to get to you, sir, you'll be in a better location. So go ahead with the mailbag, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. First, I would like to extend my appreciation and the thanks to all of these young people and the older ones, too, that have been sending me emails. Very complimentary. Many of them are a little irritated with the problem that's been going on. And, you know, they hear the questions. Sometimes they can't hear the answers, but they're hanging in there, and I promise them we have our president, Richie, who has organized a crew that's trying to solve this problem, and it will be corrected. So just hang in there with us, and we'll keep going, and eventually this problem is going to be solved. Let me get my notes, please. KC2WGB. One second.
And while John is getting his notes, I'll inject something that John is probably going to say, and that is that people in the Midwest who do fox hunting and bunny hunting, as it's called, on flat lands with friendly people, it's a nice, easy thing to zero in on a transmitter. In the case of a metropolitan area like New York City, with tall buildings and reflections between the marble canyons and whatever, the problem becomes 10 times more difficult. And so direction finding and zeroing in on an unintentional transmitter or whatever in that environment becomes a lot more difficult. So it isn't because the people locally don't care. We care. It's a very difficult problem. This is a very disgruntled individual who's got an awful lot of unhappiness in his life, is the best I can think of. And he's talked some of his friends into joining him, and I'm kind of amazed that they're being used by my standards. They're taking the high risk of doing jamming from their moving automobiles, and they are more vulnerable than he is. He's in a rather secure location, but his friends are not so secure, and I'm amazed that they're willing to do that. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, for our first question, it comes from Bob. Up in Queens, I believe. And he has a question that he has two scanners and he has a disc cone. And he wants to run both scanners on the same disc cone. Now, he had heard us discussing once with Mel and Rich video about using a splitter, which he got from Radio Shack. It goes up to 800 megahertz. He wants to know, is better to put the splitter at the antenna and run two down leads? Or should you run one down lead and split it in back of the receivers? That's basically his question. So, and that's a good one. Over to you, Dick.
When you study the insertion loss of each signal getting into the disc cone antenna and going down either two separate cables or one cable and then being split down below, you study the insertion loss on paper with known losses of the cables and loss of the splitter and whatever, it's a wash. It comes out the same. So for the most part, running one cable from the antenna down into the shack and then splitting is going to give you essentially the exact same performance. There's a couple of catches to that. And that is, depending on the isolation of the receiver, if this is the world's best splitter, and to cover all of these frequencies, most likely it's not. It's probably just a resistor splitter. But if it really was a splitter that's made out of inductors and capacitors and has very low insertion loss, then that kind of a splitter, properly constructed, can have a lot of isolation. The antenna port would split the two signals. The two signals would go to the two separate receivers. The two separate receivers would be thoroughly isolated from each other. The reason why that might be required is because on certain frequency combinations where maybe scanner number one is listening to 100 megacycles and scanner number two is listening to 50 megacycles, the local oscillator of one receiver could be a jamming signal to the other receiver, and the amount of isolation of the splitter can make that better. And so with the longer length of cables going up to the splitter at the antenna, in some cases there might be a slight improvement. On top of that, using the splitter on paper is an ideal way to go. If you didn't use the splitter, if you simply brought the coax cable down to the shack and simply installed a coaxial T connector, which at the common port goes to the antenna and the two output ports goes to the two receiver. No real splitter at all, just a T connector. At first, some people will be horrified by that. They'll say, hey, if each receiver presents a 50-ohm load and the two of them are in parallel inside the T connector, that makes 25 ohms. The antenna is supposedly 50 ohms, so is the cable. That's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That sounds terrible. If you were transmitting through that, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is significant. As a receiver, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is very insignificant in most cases. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, by the way, gives you a calculated half decibel of loss. That's very little. That's a 1/12 of an S unit, of a well-calibrated S unit, single strength receiver meter. So simply using a T connector will do the job. Not ideal. Again, certain combinations of receiving band number one on the first scanner and band number two on the second scanner might give you certain frequencies where you hear birdies, where you're hearing the local oscillator out of the other. But you'll rapidly find out where those combinations are and tune the other receiver accordingly to get around that. So you've got a lot of possibilities here. Do you really have to use that splitter? It would be an interesting experiment to bypass the splitter and find out what happens without it. You might actually hear slightly stronger signals under certain conditions. Receivers are amazingly forgiving. You can have a simple clip lead. On many HF frequencies, you can have a simple clip lead connected to the center conductor on the coaxial connector on the output, on the input of the receiver, and you'll get moderately good reception. The S meter won't move quite as far as a well-tuned antenna, but because the noise on the band is usually high enough, the actual signal-to-noise ratio with a simple clip lead antenna could be good enough in many cases. So it's an interesting experiment to try. As I said, receivers are amazingly forgiving, and use any combination of antennas and splitters and cables and T connectors and whatever that you want to use, directional couplers. Use any combination you want to on the receiver. You can't do any damage, if you know what I mean. Those are some of my opinions on running multiple receivers off the same antenna. If this was the best of all worlds, you'd have a truly broadband preamplifier somewhere in the common wire coming from the antenna down to the splitter that would increase the signal strength before the splitter, and now you would have the lowest possible noise figure into the receiver. 90% of the time, you do not need that, but that would be the Cadillac approach if you want to go the next step to making the whole system operate two receivers with absolute maximum sensitivity into each receiver. You don't have to do it, but know that that's the next step if you want to do that downrange. KC2WGB, that was a bunch of opinions on my part. Not everyone will agree with all of that. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
And KC2QIQ with a comment?
We heard both Rich and Glenn in that order, who have both done some of this. Rich first, N2EO. Wonder how you've done things like this, Rich, and what happened?
Hey, Dick. I never experimented with using a T-connector, so I can't say that the splitter is any better, but I can tell you, I took one of those splitters apart once. There are coils, inductors in there, and capacitors. I took apart a Radio Shack splitter, at least that's what I saw in that. And what the gentleman can get, those splitters use type F connectors, you know, the TV type connectors. Radio Shack, among others, has adapters to go from male type F to female BMC. So he could buy adapters to the F part onto the splitters and then hook everything up with BMC connectors and RG58 or whatever he wants to use. Back to that, Ed Tullio.
Yeah, some of your speech is a little bit distorted. The P's and the T's get a little bit distorted. Stand close to the mic, but aim the mic at a 90-degree angle to your voice, if you know what I mean, when you come back here, Rich, as an experiment. The particular splitter you bought from Radio Shack, roughly how many dollars and what frequency range is it rated for? And Rich was talking about the splitter that they sell that has F connectors, F for Foxtrot. The Kite television cable connector is a Foxtrot connector. You can also buy at Radio Shack in the bubble pack the F connectors that you can add to the cable yourself if you want to, with the crimping tool if you want to. So your particular splitter, what was its frequency range, roughly how many dollars? Over to you, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I'm upstairs right now. I've got Rich all over the house, but I'm upstairs. This microphone is not the greatest on this little Kenwood. I'm side talking the mic now. I couldn't venture a price because I haven't done it in quite a number of years, so the price went up. But I think they still sell them. They're like silver-colored splitters. At that time, they said Archer on them. I don't know what they say now, but maybe they say Candy or Jack. I don't know. I used them down to about 25 megahertz, 20 megahertz. In fact, I actually used them on the 15-meter ham band with a couple of watts. They were something I experimented with back in the 1970s. Worked on the 21 megahertz, so I was quite surprised. And they go up, I don't know where they start losing signal, but I use them successfully receiving up around 800-900 megs.
And I'm going to guess that splitter was in the $5, $10 type region nowadays. Let's see what Glenn, what kind of a splitter have you used? What frequency range? How many dollars? What's your favorite brand? And what kind of success have you had, Glenn? KC2 QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. Actually, one of the things I've done in the past, I haven't used splitters. I didn't have a lot of success with them because of the same kind of problems that were mentioned earlier, that, you know, you'll have one receiver will tend to put out some kind of a birdie into one of the other receivers. So that didn't really work too well. And the splitters, you know, just really didn't alleviate that problem at all. How I wound up getting around it was using two different antennas, and the performance was the same. One was just cone for omnidirectional. The other one was really just a TV antenna that was rotatable, so I could have a little bit of gain pointing towards the different signals. But the key to it was using a distribution amplifier in the shack. I had one here that will drive up to four receivers at the same time, and a couple of different times I was monitoring four different frequencies at the same time through four different scanners, and that completely resolved the problem altogether. So it gave actually a little bit of gain input signal, and there was no more crosstalk between receivers. And K2RIW, K2QIQ.
There's two very interesting things you said there, Glenn. Number one, there's nothing magic about the disc cone antenna. Yes, it's a little bit more broadband, but because the receiver itself is so forgiving, you could build yourself a very simple equivalent of a second antenna if you wanted to really operate two completely separate antennas. The second antenna could be a SO239 UHF connector aimed straight down. Out of the four holes in the four corners, you put four ground plane radials, and out of the center conductor, you put a radiator straight up. All of the wires could be coat hanger wire. The exact length is not super critical. and you would have moderately good reception out of that homebrew antenna, if you know what I mean. The Discone antenna is a little bit higher in performance, but you can make a temporary homebrew one and have two completely separate antennas. Now, this preamplifier distribution amplifier that you had, which really takes the input signal, amplifies it a little bit, splits it four ways with a moderate amount of isolation on the four ways. What brand name, roughly how many dollars was that? What frequency range does it cover? So your particular distribution amplifier, who and what was that, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
The one I'm using right now, Dick, is a Channel Master. It's for a four-way distribution amplifier with a small little gain control on it. And it was roughly about the, somewhere around the $80 mark, somewhere around there. And very, very nice little piece. But, you know, it's all F connector, you know, so it's basically using mostly television coax type of connection. And it works very, very well. And, you know, to get connectors that go from F to back to PL259 or to type N is really no big deal at all. And you can, or even just going over to back to B and C again. So it'll, you can really get whatever kind of connections that you need. And it's overall, I think, maximum like 15 dB gain if you turn the pot all the way up in one direction. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And one last question, Glenn. That particular Channel Master that you used, is it rated for channel 2 through channel 52, so to speak, nowadays? Your best guess. Go ahead, Glenn.
Oh, absolutely. That and then some. I believe its coverage is really like 25 megahertz to a gigahertz thick, so it's really broadband.
And because many of the inexpensive circuits you can buy at Radio Shack are made for television receiver use, and most television receivers nowadays use an F connector, Foxtrot connector, Radio Shack has in their bubble packs, quite a number of adapters that will adapt from male or female F into BNC, miniature UHF, full-size UHF, type N, and so on, lots of adapters. And so should you buy the adapters, which in some cases are a little bit pricey, or should you build your own, actually get the connector itself, build a small length of coaxial cable, and install the connector on each end of a small length of cable and make your own adapter? These are some of the choices you've got, and there's lots of ways of doing it. That crimping tool, that the exotic crimping tool that Radio Shack sells for $16 or so these days, does an extremely good job of crimping F connectors onto a RG58 or RG6-like cable. They have a much cheaper little scissor-like crimping tool, which I think is more in the $5 category. It doesn't do quite as nice a job, but maybe it's adequate. So lots of ways of going. Now, when it comes to multiple receivers interfering with each other, very inexpensive scanner-type receivers tend to have a mixer front end where the very first stage is either the mixer or it's very close to being the mixer. The local oscillator is going into that mixer, and a significant amount of the local oscillator power gets unintentionally radiated back out of the input connector of the receiver, so that certain frequency combinations of scanner number one is listening to this frequency range and scanner number two is listening to that frequency range, that local oscillator of one receiver creates a jamming signal for the other receiver. As you get to higher and higher class receivers, which have a real low noise preamplifier in the front end, which acts as a unilateralizing device. In other words, the signal flows from the input connector of that amplifier to the output connector, and it has a lot of isolation in the reverse direction. The better made receivers, like for instance an ICOM R7000, where it's got a real preamplifier, the amount of local oscillator it re-radiates is much, much smaller. Therefore, the ability of one scanning receiver to jam another one gets less and less. When it comes to military electronics, the amount of local oscillator that's re-radiated, which searchlights your position if you're flying in an airplane, it lets people know where you are because they can listen to the local oscillator, and by knowing what frequency your local oscillator is on, they know what frequency you're listening to, once they know the design of your receiver and what is the IF frequency. So as such, the military specifications for their receivers dictate that the local oscillator re-radiation should be an extremely small number, so it's undetectable outside of the aircraft, so to speak. The scanners that we tend to use tend not to be built that way, but you could add your own preamplifier, a unilateralizing device, if you wanted to make that improvement. It's doable. So you could make your scanner better and better in sensitivity and better in local oscillator isolation if you decided to. It wouldn't take you a lot of engineering and a lot of dollars to do that. Okay, back to you, John. KC2WGB for the next one, if you want to. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick.
Well,
that gives him some answers. The only thing I would add to that is I did the same thing with a splitter, and when I was listening to a weak signal because of the loss in the splitter, I just put a switch arrangement on there to eliminate the splitter and go direct to the radio. I could do it through one of them, and that worked out pretty well. And the local oscillator interference with a good splitter was not that bad, especially when you're in the scan mode, because you'll get a little birdie once in a while as you're going by, but I found it worked out very well that way. All right, we drop, and I'll go on to the next one. KC2WGB. We got a question here from Jeff. He's in a RF noisy area, and he's trying to eliminate noise. He's using open ladder line. He didn't tell me what frequency he's here. He's on. How much improvement, if any, would he have? Is he changed over to coax? Would that attenuate a lot of noise, or do you think it would be a minimum change? Back to you, Dick.
From my point of view on that one, John, for Jeff's question, there are multiple answers. If the noise is really bathing his whole neighborhood, and if the noise is really being picked up by his antenna, having the world's best shielded cable would make essentially no improvement, because the signal is on the antenna, the cable is connected to the antenna, therefore the signal on the antenna goes through the cable into the receiver and gives you the grief. If the noise happens to be, let me pick a crazy answer, if it happens to be a arcing...
Yes, he's complaining basically about ignition noise.
Yeah, ignition noise tends to bathe the whole neighborhood. So the chances of him going to a shielded cable and eliminating it is very unlikely. It's worth a try, but it's very unlikely. If the noise was coming from a arcing doorbell transformer in his house, and if the cable is going, close to the basement to that arcing transformer, or if it's going near a noisy fluorescent tube or something like that, if the signal is being picked up by his cable and the antenna is a long distance away from the source of the noise, then using better shielded cable or better balanced cable could make an improvement. Twin lead, if you really feed it correctly with balance on both ends, even though to your eye it looks like an open circuit, the twin lead looks like it should pick up a lot of signal. If the twin lead is truly used in the differential manner with the proper kind of balancing devices on both ends, and that the inexpensive-looking twin lead can be an extremely well-shielded structure. But nowadays, good coaxial cable has such a nice low insertion loss and is very well-shielded. Using coaxial cable usually solves that problem of intermediate pickup along the transmission line. But ignition noise tends to be very broadband, bathes the neighborhood, probably being picked up by the antenna, so the chances of eliminating that are very slim. Now, if what he thinks is ignition noise is an arcing power transformer in the neighborhood, and if with enough study we find out that the arcing power transformer is giving a large amount of vertical polarized noise and very little horizontal polarized noise, and sometimes power lines do the opposite, then because your transmission line comes off the antenna quite often at a right angle, by making the transmission line insensitive, sometimes it makes an improvement because it's cross-polarized to the antenna, if you know what I mean. That's a long shot. It's worth a try, but I kind of doubt it. If it's only ignition noise, usually that means you've got a rather sensitive receiver, because modern-day automobiles try to put out very little ignition noise, because if they did, the car radio would be suffering, if you know what I mean. So ignition noise from modern-day cars is quite low these days. Oh, somebody may have a noisy lawnmower or a noisy radio-wise chainsaw, but those tend to be intermittent service, if you know what I mean. So if you're receiving ignition noise continuously in your neighborhood, either somebody is running a Model T Ford, or you've got a super sensitive receiver. KC2 WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
And KC2 QIQ with a comment?
Somebody's trying to get in touch with the Titanic, Dick. Go ahead, Glenn.
You got it, Glenn.
I've experienced problems like that, you know, especially with on amateur radio and different bands, where I'm getting a lot of interference, and generally the way that I wound up clearing it up every time generally was not with a transmission line or an antenna tuner or anything like that. Usually, if I was having an interference problem, the best way that I always got around it was altitude of the antenna. If I got the antenna high enough where I could get more of the signal I was really looking for and getting away from more of the ground noise, so basically I was pushing the ratio back more towards signal as opposed to noise, and that usually took care of the problem. KTOR-IW, KC2-QIQ.
Glad you reminded me, Glenn. Changing the altitude and the orientation of the antenna, that's going to make the signal you're listening to stronger and the interference either the same or weaker, so you come out ahead. However, ignition noise, power line noise, chainsaw noise, and things like this, they have a very characteristic signature to them. There usually is an extremely brief rise time, usually a rather brief duration, and a very brief fall time. Therefore, there are kinds of noise blanker circuits that can do magic. However, there are noise clippers and noise blankers, and they differ tremendously in design and performance. By my standards, the Cadillac of noise blankers is the one that was contained as an auxiliary circuit, an add-on circuit you could add to the Drake R4C receiver. That noise blanker would take the radar noise, for instance, from the Montauk Point radar, which at times was more than 100 decibels above my noise, above my threshold when I'm listening on the 432 meg ham band. That was an extremely potent multi-mega-megawatt type radar, terawatt type radar. And boy, it was strong. And so when it was transmitting, I could aim the back of my Yagi toward Montauk Point where the radar was, aim it at a strong signal in New Jersey, where ordinarily that signal in New Jersey would be 60 decibels above my noise. The guy, you know, gangbusters, S9 plus 60 dB is the signal strength I'm getting from the guy in New Jersey. The radar comes on, I get the back of the antenna aimed toward the radar, the front of the antenna aimed at the guy in New Jersey, and I cannot hear the guy in New Jersey at all. I don't even know he's there. I turn on that Drake R4C noise blanker, the radar completely disappeared. I could now reverse the process. I could aim the Yagi directly at the Montauk Point radar, and the back lobes of my antenna are aimed at the guy in New Jersey, and I'm hearing him like gangbusters, and I don't even know the radar is there. The same thing when it comes to ignition noise and power line noise. That blanker really had capability. I was so impressed with that particular blanker that I took that circuit apart, studied the schematic diagram, figured out how they did it. And it was a very fancy, very low switching transient FET transistor switching network at the very front end of the IF strip of that receiver, so that it would detect the leading edge of the noise before it got through a delay line. It would open up that switch before the big pulse of energy from the noise got a chance to send the IF strip ringing like a bell. That switch would be opened during the duration of the noise pulse, and then it would go back to normal conduction, and you would hear essentially nothing. Beautiful circuit. The Kenwood 520 receiver also had a very good noise, so did the 820. So there are certain ham radio receivers that have an extremely good noise blanker. So with the right kind of a noise blanker, as long as the duty factor of your noise, and ignition noise tends to be, you know, 0.1% of the time is the actual noise coming out of the source, the ignition noise from the automobile. It's a little bit like talking about a person using a machine gun in a quiet library. The peak power of the noise coming out of the machine gun is extremely large in that quiet library. The average noise coming out of the machine gun is very low. If you have the right kind of a noise blanker, a person, in theory, could operate a machine gun in a library, and you'd be able to hear the speaker, if you know what I mean. You'd have to make sure there's no echo in that library, but in the radio sense, seeking a really good noise blanker is another approach, and that's an art and science in itself, because an awful lot of the things that are called noise clipper and noise blanker, an awful lot of them do a very mediocre job compared to the one that was in those Drake receivers and the one that was in that some of those Kenwood receivers. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I'm sure that's good news for these guys. They have something to work on, which is what it's all about. That's about it from Null's Corner for this week. Also, I want to put out my email address again, and I know the problems we're having has diminished some of the emails. There weren't that many this week to choose from. So I'd like to encourage you guys to keep sending them. And tonight we had a pretty good run, and maybe this will continue. So that's, you send your emails to Juliet Baker 5 Oscar at AOL.com. And I'll forward them to Dick, and we'll get on the card again. Wonderful hair. Back to you, Dick.
I know that John has a question, but we're going to go over to the NASA report right now, if Paul's available. WS2N, go right ahead with your NASA report, Paul. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. WS2N. Yeah, not much. I definitely wanted to mention a launch coming up at the end of the month, on the 30th. And I've mentioned it before, the Dragon spacecraft, a commercial flight being flown, a commercial rocket, Falcon 9, let me drop it. And it's being launched by SpaceX, and it launches right out of Florida. Only one launch pad away from where the shuttles used to launch. And they've had two test flights before, one suborbital and the other one orbital. And the last one that was orbital in December of last year, there was supposed to be another one after that, but since it was so successful, NASA gave them the okay. Being successful, I mean that went into orbit, it showed maneuvering capabilities, and it also deorbited with successful parachutes, and it landed in the Pacific where it was supposed to. So unlike all the other supply vehicles that go to the space station, this one will go to the space station and be able to bring things back. It's reusable. So it's a step in the right direction. So it's a test. It's a test, but actually they're bringing up supplies. About 1,200 pounds worth of supply. Nothing crucial, because it is a test flight. It might not make it. You never know. Let me drop it. So I think it's roughly about an 8-day flight. It's going to take a couple days to get there, and then they'll stay docked for a while. They're going to load it up with scientific equipment, things they want to bring back to Earth, and it'll fly back and land in the ocean. The other progress ship, and the Japanese H-2 and the European Space Agency ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle, they bring supplies up. If they want to get rid of garbage here, they put it inside of that because they deorbit and burn up over the Pacific. This nice spacecraft is going to be able to be reusable. And in the future, it won't be landing in the water. They're going to have retro rackets on it, so this way when it comes down close to the ground, they'll fire them and it'll soften the land and they'll bring it back to Earth. Same spacecraft will be converted in the future also to bring up to 7 astronauts or a combination of astronauts and supplies up to the space station. So I wish them luck. Drop it. Got solar panels on this thing. And, it's really quite interesting. Naturally, it's got a pressurized area. It dock with the with the space station, but not in the same sense that the Progress Russian ship or the ATV does. They do it automatically all by themselves, autonomously, really. This is more like the H2, the Japanese module. It gets up close to the space station. Astronauts inside the cupola or the Discovery lab will reach out with the Canadian robot arm to grab a hold of it, berth it to the port. It's going to be one of the nodes, I think, the Harmony node. And it cannot be directly ported to the Russian side. It's really designed for the American side. So it should be good. It's called the Dragon, and it's going to be launched by Falcon 9, also by the same company. I wanted to mention that. And also, one other little thing. Let me drop it. That's designing a clock, and it sounds kind of mundane, but it's a time o'clock mercury ion system that will fly on spacecraft. And right now they use the time o'clock on Earth. They'll run transmissions up to a spacecraft, either manned or unmanned, and based on that time o'clock and the frequency and the distance and this and that, that's how they make calculations to do things, change orbits, rendezvous, land on other planets. So better accuracy in the future, especially when they get further out in the solar system. They plan on having their own atomic clock on board spacecraft, which I found pretty interesting that they really don't have that now. They'll have the clock on board. It'll be doing its own calculations. So let's say it's going to land on Mars or a moon of Mars or the moon of Saturn somewhere, or even the moon itself, it'll be able to do its own calculations. WS2N. So it's quite a while away before they even test this thing. In fact, you know, it's 2015, but they're just working on the design now. They'll test it on, well, the Iridium project. That might be one of these GPS type of satellites, big constellation of Iridium going up. On one of them, they'll put the mercury ion system. So that's pretty much it. I didn't have much, but I did want to mention the Dragon flight coming up at the end of this month on the 30th, 12:22 Eastern Standard Time. So what is that? Monday, I believe. Back to that, WSUS.
Got a couple of questions on this one, Paul. The 8-day mission, I think it's 1,200 pounds of hardware is going to be brought up. SpaceX is the company. Falcon 9 is the name of the booster, and Dragon is the name of the craft that's going to bring up the 1,200 pounds of what you call it now, stores, hardware, replaceable material. Does the Dragon have the ability to launch human beings at some later time after it's been fully qualified, or is it only made for lifting replaceable hardware? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, it's dual function for now. Of course, in the beginning it's going to be cargo, but in the future it will be used for astronauts. They will be able to carry up to 7 people, 3 in the front, 4 down below. When I say down below, you know, it's stacked on top of the rocket. So you have an ability to, let's say, carry 2 astronauts or 3 and then a bunch of cargo if need be, so you'll be able to do both. That's in the works. They do have the contract for it. There's money allocated by NASA to have these people develop it. It's through the COTS program, Commercial Orbital, Transportation Service, I think it's called. And there's a bunch of companies that are doing this. There's something called the Dream Chaser by Orbital Science. It's being developed. Another system. But this one's way ahead of everybody. So that's it. Definitely going to be used for both. It's big. You put the whole story of spacecraft inside this thing, inside the Dragon.
That's amazing. I'm amazed that you told me 7 astronauts. That makes it sound like this Dragon spacecraft made by this commercial company, non-NASA, non-military, called SpaceX. I'm beginning to find that, think that Dragon is about one half the volume of a space shuttle. Is that approximately true, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, not a, but shuttle is, what, 250,000 pounds or some ridiculous number. This is, if they're only about, you know, 7-8 tons, you know, 16,000 pounds in that area. Don't forget the shuttle is, yeah, but, you know, you've got the front compartment area, you know, for the people, but the shuttle, 90% of it was all cargo area, you know, really comparing apples with oranges. Even when the Dream Chaser goes up, that's designed like a small shuttle rocket than the Falcon 9, and that would be launched by a NASA rocket, an Atlas V, and return and land with wheels like the shuttle that's in present design. I mean, it's hardware and things built for that already, too. Talking about two different companies, SpaceX and Orbital Flight. Got a, it's really a small shuttle. I mean, there's no cargo area for the Dream Chaser. This thing here is really cargo. When I say cargo, you know, you're going to fill up a capsule really filled with stuff, similar to what they do with the ATVs. The ATVs are automatic transit vehicles by the European Space Agency. I got ham radio on my mind, Dick. Back to you.
Now, you mentioned the word COTS, COTS. In the military world, COTS usually stands for commercial off the shelf. Is what that usually stands for. But maybe in this case it has another meaning. Now, when it comes to this very accurate clock, you called it a mercury ion clock. And that's a brand new kind of a clock that I haven't heard about. Most of the clocks I've heard of that have high accuracy are rubidium or cesium beam. Cesium beam is the most expensive, the most elaborate, and the highest accuracy clock. And then rubidium is the next one down from that. So mercury ion clock, is that something that works very well in microgravity but not so well on Earth? Is that why this being sent into space, or is this a brand new clock that's going to challenge the accuracy of cesium or rubidium? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of it. That's it. I don't see much information about it yet. I'll have to research it further. You know, it's only something new that NASA posted on their site. Quick little thing, and then you had to go further, deeper into it to eventually find out what they were talking about. No, I'll have to research that more. But the COTS is, I believe it's a commercial orbital transportation service. It's not system or anything. That's what they call the COTS program. Anybody want to jump on that bandwagon? If you like the Dream Chaser by Orbital Mechanics, it's being built by somebody else, and the company bought it up, but, you know how to buy up deal goes in the commercial world. Now, because the Dream Chaser was going to be dropped, and because this company got a hold of it, they're on their way to possible launch a couple of years from now. I believe it's Orbital Science. They're also the ones that are launched the Minotaur from Kodiak Island in Alaska. They've launched the Pegasus from Kwajalein Island, and they launched the their own vehicle they want to launch also from Wallop Island. That's where their headquarters, Virginia. Get my name straight. I believe it's Orbital Science. Back to you.
Giving me some nice things to look up with NASA. I thank you, Paul. One last question. I know, I'm pretty sure of the answer to this. Are we absolutely positive that the space shuttle will never fly again? I know that we've canceled the program, we've laid off all those people, but my goodness, did that have payload capability, lift capability? Yes, it had some risk involved, but from your point of view, Paul, are we absolutely positive that the United States space shuttle will never fly again? WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, that's history. Each one was built for 100 flights, each one had an average of less than 30 flights, or maybe 33 on one of them. Actually, I remember when they were designed, they said 100 flights each, or 30 years, whichever comes first, you know, so I guess that's